Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm happy to be talking today with Carl Janssen, who is a psychiatrist. He goes back and forth between New Zealand and London, England, long commute. Anyway, he's particularly interested in the brain science, and has most recently written a book called K, Ketamine, Dreams and Realities. And ketamine, I thought I was pretty sophisticated about what goes on in the world, but I didn't realize that ketamine is actually part of the rave scene. And the rave scene is a very, very big in Europe and the United States, anyway. I don't know what else. And you're here, Carl Janssen, because of a conference going on here in Berkeley, Mind States, which is about entheogens, and I'm really sorry to say I missed your presentation yesterday, but I'm really happy to have this opportunity to talk to you, and it's always important for people to know what's going on with drugs, or the whole drug war thing that makes it sort of lumps everything together and just says, say no, and basically, as you say in your book, that doesn't work anyway, so it's important for people to be informed. What led you particularly to write about ketamine?
Well, one of the most interesting things about ketamine is that a lot of people who have taken it say that they had a near-death experience where they go down tunnels at high speed, perhaps come out into the light, have a telepathic communion with God, learn important moral lessons about themselves and their lives. And I found that very interesting, that you could have a near-death experience as a result of this drug and not just when you're lying on the ground actually near death. Because a near-death experience can have many positive after-effects. So the question it raises is, well, could we safely help people to have near-death experiences for therapeutic purposes? Because ketamine is a drug with an accepted place in human medicine, sometimes said to be an elephant tranquilizer or a cat tranquilizer. Well, it is found in an awful lot of hospitals and given to an awful lot of humans as an anesthetic. So if we can give it to humans, and we're allowed to give it to humans, perhaps we could look into its use for psychotherapeutic purposes.
Yeah, well, near death, that sounds like, ooh, who wants to have a near-death experience? But I mean, I guess a lot of people do, for one thing, and it can be really transformative.
Yes, a near-death experience doesn't mean that you're actually near death. Most people who think they're near death, in a near-death experience, nowhere near death. In fact, ketamine speeds your heart up, speeds up your breathing, and raises the blood pressure. It's nothing like this film Flatliners, where people sort of took a drug and actually tried to die. It's not considered to be particularly dangerous. In fact, the ketamine is mostly used for children and old people and people having asthmatic crises, but specifically because it doesn't usually suppress breathing. It's one of the very few anesthetics that takes your mind out of your body, puts your mind somewhere else so that things can be done to your body, but your body actually speeds up a bit. It's quite a rare for an anesthetic, so it's a speedy anesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And it's illegal in the United States, I think, is it not?
I wouldn't put it quite that way. Laws control most things everywhere. Ketamine is a Schedule 3 drug in the United States, which is quite different from Schedule 2 or Schedule 1. LSD is a Schedule 1 drug, which means it has no human use and is very difficult to work with. Ketamine was an uncontrolled drug until August 1999, quite recently, when it became a Schedule 3 drug. But Schedule 3 is fairly small potatoes. It's still prescribable by doctors, and it's still used in medicine.
Mm-hmm. So it's still used in hospitals in the United States?
Oh, yes, it's still used in hospitals in the United States.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, as you were saying in your book, that it can be considered this great thing 1 minute and the next minute. if people want to use it for their own enlightenment, that's a no-no. You want to say more about that?
Well, that is very interesting, that for decades we've had ketamine. It hasn't suddenly appeared. It was invented in 1962. It was licensed for human use at the end of the 60s. So for decades we've had this very potent psychedelic drug available in your local hospital, pumped intravenously into children and the elderly, and nobody's really bothered about it. And then, of course, we have LSD as a very evil Schedule 1 drug for which you go to prison for many, many years, and which you certainly can't inject into children and old people for any reason whatsoever. And I think that that does bring up some of the paradoxes of the war on drugs. If there's money to be made, if there's a pharmaceutical company involved, everything is fine. If there's no pharmaceutical company involved and the big drug companies can't make any money out of it, whammo, it's Class A illegal and you can't do anything with it at all. Mm-hmm. You see, I mean, ketamine is made by Pfizer, and while it's not particularly big in the United States, ketamine is one of the biggest anesthetics throughout the developing world. It's a huge drug in China because it's very, very cheap. You don't need an anesthetist, you just whack it into someone, do your little operation on them, and that's fine. So if the United States decided to move against ketamine in a big way and made it Schedule 1, that would create quite a big economic loss for one of the world's largest pharmaceutical giants. So that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why, even though it was scheduled, it's only in Schedule 3, although it's probably one of the most powerful psychedelic drugs we know. D.M. Turner, who is author of The Essential Guide to Psychedelics, said that ketamine was the ultimate psychedelic journey. So there you go, the ultimate psychedelic journey, not a Schedule 1 drug. Mm-hmm. There is a paradox there.
Really? And I guess if you're going to have an operation, you may as well have some ketamine.
I talked to someone yesterday who said that he'd been told to ask for ketamine for his vasectomy. So he said to his doctor, "I'd like ketamine for my vasectomy." And they were very titillated with the idea and very pleased to do it. And they did give him ketamine. He had a very interesting time. And he said that unlike almost all the other vasectomies, he had no pain afterwards at all. It was a vasectomy reversal. And he said it worked perfectly well, and he had no pain at all. And people often have a lot of pain after these. He said not only was the ketamine very interesting, but for some reason I had no post-operative pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly a recommendation. So what is happening in the rave world, or the rave world, but in the world of people who want to explore their consciousness, change their consciousness for spiritual or recreational reasons?
Well, those are two very different worlds, the worlds of the hedonist Dionysians, if you like, the followers of Bacchus, and then the Apollonian people like Timothy Leary at Harvard, who are much more highbrow about the way in which they use drugs. So in the rave scene, we have the very ancient tradition of drum beats, which of course has been going on for thousands of years, repetitive drumming, dancing around the fire, which these days has become a light show, and the taking of all sorts of substances to alter consciousness.
I just want to say that I am surprised at the many people that I speak to. Well, I'm definitely an elder, but I have lots of young friends, and I definitely know about the rave scene, and a lot of people don't even know about it, and it's huge, is my impression. I hear that in England there are raves that have 20,000-30,000 people.
That's right. Rave culture is probably the biggest thing happening in youth culture, but it isn't really youth culture there anymore. It started in 1985, and a lot of the top DJs are in their 40s now, so it's already 15 or 16 years. Time passes, even for you. But it's a very large thing, and the rave culture has led to a huge upsurge of interest in psychedelic drugs in general, psychedelic culture. People refer back to the 60s, but I don't really believe in decadism. I mean, in the Victorian era, people didn't talk about the 40s and the 50s. What we're into now is the psychedelic era. It began in the early 1960s, and it's probably going full tilt at the moment, because if we look at statistics, certainly for the UK, about 14% of children aged under 17 have taken LSD. In fact, it's the highest of the most frequently taken illegal drug, almost more than cannabis, because it's very, very cheap. It's just about economics. You can buy a trip for a pound. Cannabis is very expensive in England, as most people who have gone there and tried to buy it have discovered, mm-hmm. and very bad as well. So a lot of people have taken psychedelic drugs as a result of this combination of music and culture, but it is very big there. And I don't really know what the situation is in the United States. The use of ecstasy and ketamine in clubs started in the United States and in the gay clubs of New York and also in Los Angeles. Then it was exported out to Ibiza in Spain and to Goa in India. It was imported from there into England. The English sort of redid it, a bit like the Beatles with originally American music, re-exported it everywhere. Now I'm not entirely sure what's happening. There's been a very big crackdown in New York, which has pushed it back underground again. In Europe, just the opposite. We see clubs becoming completely mainstream culture. One of the interesting things about rave is that it has brought psychedelic drugs into contact with ordinary people who wouldn't normally have taken drugs like that. But these are people who go to clubs where alcohol is sold, and now suddenly they find all these other drugs there as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's just what's happening. It's what people are, that's what they're doing. It's just the mass cultural thing.
I think a lot of ordinary people who are not ravers at all have been brought into contact with a lot of illegal drugs that they wouldn't normally have taken because that movement is happening in ordinary clubs where ordinary people go. And it has led to a big movement of drug use into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. And where does ketamine in particular fit into this? Is there anything else you want to say about it, actually? It's very interesting because I know that you, Carl Jansen, are looking at the social effects and the psychological effects and are well-grounded in the science of the brain. So whatever you want to say about it.
Well, ketamine's not a good drug to take in clubs because it's an anesthetic and you're likely to fall over. So I think it's actually a pretty silly choice as a club drug. The other side of its non-medical use are people who stay home and explore the drug for its effect on the mind, particularly to try and transcend themselves and have spiritual experiences. So that's the alternative spirituality side.
Mm-hmm. And what happens? Well, in this book, K, Ketamine, Dreams and Realities, that you have... this book just came out, Carl Jansen?
That book has just been released. All the profits from that book go to research. It's published by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, and you can't really buy it at a local bookshop. If you want to obtain Ketamine Dreams and Realities, you have to go to www.maps.org. That's www.maps.org or MAPS. You can buy it from Amazon.com, but would rather that people didn't, because then MAPS loses quite a lot of the money. So it's either Amazon.com is the fastest and simplest way that most people know, or it's the MAPS website, but mm-hmm. you won't get it at your local shop yet.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. I do see that the profits, 100% of the profits, are devoted to ketamine psychotherapy research. So that's...
Soviet Union. That research, in Russia, rather. I'm getting old.
Right.
That research takes place in St. Petersburg, and basically it's a chap called Evgeny Kupritsky, who's a very respected addiction psychiatrist, and he uses ketamine to create a very intense death-rebirth experience for people who have serious alcohol dependence. He's been doing that for at least 10 to 15 years. He's treated thousands of alcoholics with really excellent results. So it's not some crackpot weird idea that they're doing in Russia where they can ignore normal ethical principles. The people that they do this to have already been in rehab for 3 months usually, and they've developed quite a strong psychotherapeutic relationship, but they've got no money at all in Russia. So every little bit of money that gets sent there keeps the light on a bit longer in Evgeny's lab and helps very serious Russian alcoholics to recover.
Oh, that's really interesting. That makes me think about the early days of LSD and how it was talked about. It really helped alcoholics and schizophrenics, and boom, the lid was put on in terms of, for the overwhelmingly most part, in terms of researcher use. Because in the United States, I mean, you're talking about Russia, but in the United States, it seems to me also there's a lot of repression, which you alluded to earlier in terms of the economic reasons sometimes for that repression.
Well, ketamine is a much more suitable drug as a psychotherapeutic aid because it is much shorter acting. It's quite well understood. There are about 6,500 papers about ketamine in the Medline database. which is rather a lot more than there are about LSD or ecstasy. So there have been many, many clinical trials, mostly by anaesthetists, looking at what ketamine does. It is fairly well understood. And if you're given ketamine as an anaesthetic, you're likely to be given 10 times as much as you would need for a psychedelic dose. The psychedelic dose is low. If you go much over that, you just knock people out. Sometimes people who are given ketamine as an anaesthetic have been given such a huge amount that they don't have any psychedelic experience at all. They're just knocked out, bang, and then they come back again. So we're talking about much smaller doses than you're likely to get in hospital. And it's much shorter acting. You're looking at something that isn't very likely to last for more than an hour or so. A lot of problems with LSD. LSD, people are much more likely to have bad experiences, very emotional experiences. It lasts for 6 to 8 hours, which is a very long time if things are going wrong. So the possibilities for post-LSD negative effects are somewhat higher. So ketamine really has many advantages, I think, over LSD. There were certainly problems with the use of LSD as a psychotherapeutic aid, and I think that ketamine overcomes some of those problems.
Mm-hmm. So do you, as a psychiatrist, recommend it in terms of, or do you work with it in terms of psychotherapy?
I think that any substance could only be an aid within a psychotherapeutic alliance. I don't think that in this, with the drugs like this, that the drugs themselves are the treatment, which is something that people don't always understand. Even with LSD psychotherapy in the 1960s, it wasn't the LSD that is the treatment. It is that there is a therapy going on between you and the therapist, and at a certain point, a profoundly altered state of consciousness can help that therapy to move on past certain blockages. If a drug like ketamine was going to be used as an aid to psychotherapy, it would be the same. This would be within a therapeutic alliance at a certain point where it was considered to be a useful aid. If you don't think that way, you just end up doing the normal therapy that you would otherwise do while on the drug. So why bother with the complication? The thing to remember about Krupitsky's work in St. Petersburg is that he has those patients in there for 3 months, building them up to this huge death-rebirth experience. There's a big build-up to it. There's a lot of indoctrination that they will have a profoundly transformative experience after which they will not drink. So there's a lot of deliberate programming, which they do because alcoholism is a very serious condition. A lot of people die of it.
And it's hard to get over.
Well, people saying, what, you're programming them? What is this? It's like Clockwork Orange or something. Well, firstly, one could say, well, people volunteer for this. They're not forced to do it like in Clockwork Orange. It's not some state-sponsored program. They volunteer for it. They have a positive relationship with the people that they're doing it with, built up over time. And they have a very serious condition. You don't really get into a program like this unless you have intractable alcoholism that you've had for quite a few years, and when you've failed at most other treatments, when you're likely to die, your family are likely to suffer, and society is likely to suffer if you don't get some treatment. So it's a bit like a serious operation, I guess. I mean, there's a point where you really do need to have an operation for something. Certainly not for everybody, but I think if the disease is, or the condition that you have is bad enough, then you start to look at more of these edge treatments. Certainly at the moment, this would be an edge treatment.
Mm-hmm. And you, Carl Janssen, work with as a consulting psychiatrist in both New Zealand and England with families and children. Maybe this is a good time to say a few words about that in relation to whatever your other work.
Yes, in London, I mostly work on the assessment, with the assessment of drug and alcohol addicted parents whose children have been removed by social services. To see what we can do, what the prognosis is, what the rehab prospects are. So I can see firsthand a lot of the tremendous damage that drugs do, particularly heroin and crack cocaine, to families, and particularly that alcohol does to families. And also the fact that some of our treatment methods that we have are not particularly successful. And we do need to be open-minded about new possibilities. I don't think that this new sort of ketamine therapy that is being worked on in St. Petersburg is a big panacea or the answer. We're always getting panaceas. There's always some new substance or some new therapy that It's being presented to us as the ultimate treatment for heroin dependence. You know, you fly off to some far-off place, get naloxone for 3 days, or sleep therapy or something. I don't think that people are that naive anymore, but because the situation is grave and these problems are very difficult to treat, we should certainly be open-minded to the ones that do come along, especially when you have quite favourable long-term follow-up statistics. Kupritsky has been following his people up for a number of years to see how many stay sober compared to a control group of people who didn't have that treatment, see how long they stay sober. And I think that he does get quite good results with what he's doing. They're at least as good as results from other approaches. And so I think that when you see that the harm that drug addiction and alcohol do, if there are new treatments or new approaches to old treatments, it's a good idea for us to be open to them.
It just occurred to me to ask you about Ibogaine, because I understand that just one Ibogaine experience, and that's a plant medicine from a certain part of Africa, that just one experience with that can get people over all these serious addictions. And of course, I say of course, my own cynicism about the laws and politics in the United States. It's illegal in the United States, I understand. So not entirely. Well, anyway, tell me.
As far as I know, there is some work being done in the United States, some research work with Ibogaine and cocaine dependence. I know that Deborah Mash was looking at this. I'm not sure where things are at with that. But it is possible to apply for permissions to do research in some of these areas, certainly. It's not completely and utterly impossible. The promise of Ibogaine is indeed a one-off treatment that will reset your pleasure system. When you become a drug addict, your dopamine pleasure system in the middle of your brain gets reset, and it needs much more stimulation to release a normal amount of dopamine. So you need more stimulation for the same amount of pleasure as a usual person. Resetting that essentially involves a sort of, what Ibogaine amounts to, in my opinion, is almost a little bit of a chemical operation, if you like. That's more like a chemical lobotomy than a psychotherapeutic experience. It is a psychedelic drug. You do have a psychedelic experience which can be sacred and transformative. But I think that Ibogaine also causes some persistent changes in the wetware of your brains. You have the hardware, which is actually the neurons and brain cells, and you have the software, which is the programs that run them, and then you have the wetware, which is all the chemicals going to and fro. My understanding of Ibogaine is that it can actually cause some persistent changes in the wetware, which will reset your pleasure system back to normal again. Now, if you don't have a drug dependency problem, you're actually talking about taking a drug that causes some persistent changes in the brain. So I'm not sure it's something that one would want to do unless you actually had a need. It's a bit like having your appendix removed unnecessarily. As far as I see it, as a form of neurochemical operation rather than a neurosurgical operation, but a little bit like a kind of psychosurgery, if you like. Probably worth doing for some people, probably something that you shouldn't do unless you do have a serious dependence. I say if you don't have the condition, probably better off not to take the medicine.
Oh, there's so much to talk about. I'm really thinking of a lot of questions as we're talking, because there's the whole issue of the science, which is kind of the religion of the Western European, United States, Canada, world, and then there are the spiritual issues and why people want to do these things and their benefits. We haven't talked about the issue of why people want to do it, and a little bit more maybe about that.
Well, I think that people have always wanted to transcend themselves throughout known history. There's a desire to, your awareness is at the very top of your being. At the very peak of your being is your current awareness, but below that there are many, many levels of self. I mean, if you just sit there right now and move your finger, and go on, do it, move your finger, you're not thinking finger move, are you? In fact, you're thinking nothing at all about that finger. Nowhere in your current awareness will you find a trace of thought about that finger. I just said finger move. So immediately you know that there are deeper levels of your mind that are taking care of business. The question is, how deep do those levels go? Now, I think that they go right to the very core. And what do you find at the core? Nothing. A huge quantum realm of infinity. And when I say nothing, I don't mean to minimize it. I think at the center of yourself, you'll find an infinite boundaryless, timeless, eternal space. And it's in that space that magical events occur, if you like, that probably that some types of dreaming take place. Because it's in the quantum space that it's possible for a particle to be in two places at the same time. These are things that people get Nobel Prizes for. Mm-hmm. Magic, mystery, and matrix, as a Nobel Prize winner said in Time magazine recently. That's what he called his M theory. And string theory is about sort of little strings that vibrate in 11 dimensions. I mean, the language becomes very, very weird and esoteric. And you think, well, if people are getting Nobel Prizes for that sort of talk, then it's not particularly unreasonable for us to talk about having a quantum realm inside the mind. Why do people take them? I think that one of the reasons why people take psychedelic drugs in particular is so that they can explore those realms from which they're normally cut off. Sometimes people have a feeling that there are very important parts of themselves that they're not in contact with. So they take a psychedelic drug in particular because psychedelics do cut through very quickly through all these walls and allow people to transcend themselves to levels that they're not normally in touch with. And that can be important and therapeutic for them to get back in touch with what can be a very much larger part of themselves. And they come away from that refreshed and renewed and sometimes realizing that the degree of their connection with other people is much greater than they thought. Sometimes people who have these experiences, it's a sacred experience, and sacredness really means connectivity with other people. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit nicer to other people, a bit more altruistic, less sociopathic, less greedy, a bit more concerned about looking after the earth and the people on it. And these are frequent results from a near-death experience, for example. They're frequent results from profound psychedelic experiences, and they're frequent results from normal sacred experiences that people who go to church have. It's quite unnecessary to take a drug to have these experiences.
Yeah, but also other things you're saying, of course, put it in the context that it also can be very positive. And just from being at this conference that we're both at Mind States, people who don't do psychedelics, I mean, often lump it together with drugs that are really bad for you and really destroy you physically and mentally and emotionally, psychologically. And they lump all these things together. Whereas the psychedelics are really different and very highly functioning people. It is a kind of a counterculture that is very people are underground because it's illegal. But it's big.
Yes, you wouldn't really want to link the Spanish Inquisition with sort of a modern spiritual church either. I mean, these are different ways of transcending yourself, and I think people need to make distinctions and not be lazy about their thinking. Crack cocaine is certainly a very different drug from LSD, which is also different from ketamine. I think that we should find out a little bit more about the distinctions between these different substances.
Right. Well, and you're certainly helping to do that. Again, my guest is Carl Jansen, who is a psychiatrist. He goes back and forth between New Zealand and London. Long trip. Anyway, this book is called Ketamine, Dreams and Realities. And you can get it by going to www.maps.org. His personal email, Carl Jansen, is k@binternet.wm
com.
Of
and
course.
I welcome questions there. Yeah, I do welcome questions at k@btinternet.com.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carl Jansen. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.